You will get this rhythm soon.
Tonight, I'm very happy to have returned to the store Nakhla Zema Dreamed and Nel Joba Ogun Dorje. Yeah, I cracked. I think we were here exactly 6 months ago, and by the lunar calendar, it really would be exactly 6 months ago, because when we were here before, it was Vesak, Buddha's birthday enlightenment day. Full moon is shining, so it's wonderful to have them both here on such an auspicious occasion. And they are both teachers in the Arotir tradition of Nyingma Buddhism. I think I got that right. And they will be speaking tonight on teachings and songs from the tradition of Heaven Light. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
But let's, can I introduce you a little
Please?
Bit? Yeah. So we gave out a little handout that has the text for a couple of yogic songs that we'll do tonight. And the first one is one of many tunes for the what our Lama calls a seven-line song, or seven-line supplication to Padmakara, seven-line prayer, there's various ways of putting it. And this version is from the Arotir, and we practice it as yogic song, which means that as you're singing, you rest your attention on the sound more than necessarily the meaning of the words. The object of meditation is the sound itself. So we'll sing it several times, and as you pick up the tune, just join in.
As we go through, we will explain various aspects of our tradition, robes and what they mean, and that sort of thing. And there will be all the time everybody needs for questions also.
We encourage questions.
Thank you.
Leaves me feeling like, oh, what do I say? My name is Nachma Zermeg Dremeg. Nachma is a title. It means I've taken a particular set of vows. Zermeg Dremeg is my name. It means uninhibited rays of fire or something like that. But usually when a lama gives you a name, it's a challenge. And when I'm not doing this, I make my living as a technical writer. I'm married to Carl. We live in half-time in Berkeley and half-time in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada in Calaveras County in a small town called Railroad Flat, and spend a good bit of our time cutting brush. That's as much introduction as I can come up with.
I'm Naljorpa Urgyen Dorje. Naljorpa is also a title that indicates the kind of vows I've taken. In our tradition, we have Nakmas and Nakpas, which are based in their ordination mostly in Mahayoga, or theoretically in Mahayoga. And the Naljors, both Pa and Ma for men and women, are based in their ordination in Anuyoga, which is their, each of those is one of the inner tantras. So our lineage is very much based and focused almost exclusively within the inner tantras. And in the Nyingma scheme, Dzogchen is the innermost, the ninth tantra. So our lineage is also heavily imbued with the view and the approach of Dzogchen. Urgyen is a Tibetan way of saying Odian, which is where Padmasambhava came from, and also in mythology or legend or lore, I guess, because it can't be traced there so far in terms of fact, the origin of Tantra. But it also, because Tantra is based in emptiness, it also means the place where Tantra arises in mind. It's not only a physical place. And Dorje is the Tibetan word for Vajra, which people have described as indestructible or adamantine, but it's important to recognize that what makes it indestructible is that it's empty. And I'll talk about emptiness and form a bit later as we talk about the subject of tonight's topic. I've been a Nyingma practitioner for 22 years this year, and I live with my wife and my teenage daughter in Alameda, and I work at UC Berkeley, safety officer.
So what was the title of this talk again?
Teachings
and Songs from a Tradition of Enlightened Women.
I think there were women in there somewhere. A thing that has always been interesting to me about the particular tradition that we represent is that it came from a whole lineage of predominantly female practitioners. I mean, there were men as well. The lineage holders almost all the way down the line were women. And this is not so unusual, but it's something that we in the West haven't learned about the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, that kind of lineage existed. We see representatives of it, but often we don't know what we're looking at. anytime you see, for instance, a Tibetan Lama with hair, you know, got a top knot, you're looking at a man who's married, is not a monk. I didn't know that for a long time. You know, someone like Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, for instance, was a very famous, amazing Nyingma Lama. I remember asking somebody, how come he has hair? How come his head isn't shaved, you know? And they told me something strange, like, because he's a Tertian, a treasure discoverer, he has to be married. It took people a long time to realize that there was this whole tradition of practitioners whose practice is entirely woven into fairly ordinary lives that we kind of hadn't heard about in the West so much.
Still not so well known.
We're hoping that we're improving that situation somewhat.
You still read people like the late Dzogchen Rinpoche, who was the head of the Nyingma lineage for many years, and certainly the most highly regarded Nyingma Lama of the 20th century, referred to as a layman because he didn't cut his hair and wasn't a monk. Many, many people do not understand that there is a tantric ordination, which is what Dr. was describing.
Yes. Yeah. And it seems like this is important, particularly important for us here now in this culture, in this time. It's not just that if my lineage consists of a number of women, that's good for me because I can sort of identify. Although that's nice, I'm not complaining. But if you look at how religion, for want of a better term, is being used in the world right now to as a means of social control, as a means of hurting people, as a form of oppression, it's going on all over the world. There are people. You know, there's a number of people out there writing books saying we should ban all religion because look what's being done with it. I can't remember, there's three of them, and I can't remember any of their names. Christopher Hitchens is one of them. Religion is a bad thing, period, because, and then you can start counting them off on your fingers. And in all of those cases, if you look at it, it's like they've taken an aspect of spirituality is particularly useful in trying to control people and try to make that the whole thing. And when you look at a lineage of mostly female practitioners who have practiced their religion as part of somewhat ordinary life, you're looking at something that end runs around that whole sense of using religion as social control. Nakchong Rinpoche, our teacher, explained this once. He said, well, why would you want to try and keep women out of sort of the center of a religious practice? And I said, I don't know. And he said, because women have children and they teach their children. So you cannot control who gets what. So when you look at this lineage, you're looking at the possibility that spiritual practice can be something positive and something that can help people, something that includes everyone. Any part of Buddhism from about the beginning of the Mahayana on, which is sort of the second of the three levels of Buddhism, states as a principle that all beings possess or are Buddha nature, enlightened. Buddha means awake, literally. That we all have this basic awake essence. And so it is not possible, actually, to say, well, yeah, but these have more of it than everybody else. But somehow, because we're human beings and we like to have this over here and that over there and know that we're special from one or the other. We keep kind of putting things into boxes like that. And what this lineage of enlightened women shows me is it doesn't have to be that way. That all of these women had partners and children and taught their children. The story I'd like to tell you tonight, we were trying to talk about how to... We can't tell you the story of the whole lineage. We only have an hour. But what I thought of was there's a particular woman in this lineage that I'd like to talk about. And briefly, our lineage goes all the way back to Yeshet Zogel, who was the principal consort of Padmasambhava, who was the person who brought Buddhism from India to Tibet. And it passes through various women between Yeshet Zogel and Kyungchen Aro Lingma, who was the treasure finder or Tertön who revealed the particular teachings. Like, for instance, that song we just sang was a terma of Kyungchen Aro Lingma, something that she received. And in that lineage is a woman by the name of Machik Lobdrin. Have people heard of her? She's the person whose life I'd like to talk about a little bit as a way of illustrating, because it's easier to give an example than it is to talk in the abstract. And I cannot remember dates or stuff like that, so I have to have it all written down. But do you have Machik Lobdrin and the Foundations of Chöd here? There's a book. If you want to find out more about her, which is actually a translation of a Namtar, which is one of these sort of somewhat magical biographies that they used to write in Tibet about people. So Jérôme Edu, who wrote this book, translated this Namtar and then did a good deal of commentary. And if you like this sort of thing, it's very interesting. She lived supposedly from 1055 to 1153, so she supposedly was 98 when she died. And she was roughly contemporary to Milarepa. I think Milarepa was maybe 15 years older than her. So she lived at this very interesting time in terms of the development of Buddhism, because Padmasambhava had brought Buddhism to Tibet. It had flourished for quite a while. And then the outer manifestations of the institutions had all kind of gotten wiped out because of the civil war. The government in Tibet fell apart. There was a civil war, and a lot of it went underground. It didn't actually entirely go away because there were a lot of family lineages and nomadic groups and people like that who just kept right on doing it. And that's what's now called the Nyingma school, which is the school that we're connected with, which literally just means the old school. And as Buddhism started to re-arise in Tibet, there was this very interesting time when a lot of teachings were coming from India. New teachings, different from Padmasambhava, new people coming in, and a lot of new translations coming in, a lot of things going on. Things had not yet been sort of codified as they were later. And Machik Lobdrin lived during that time. She was... according to the Namtar, she was born with miraculous powers. She certainly could read from like the age of 3 and had memorized all of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, which is a stack like that, by the time she was 8. So there are those kinds of stories about her. She was terrifically gifted. And when she was young, she made her living as a churne, which means someone who just, you can hire someone to come to your house and recite sutras. If you were well off, or if, I guess, did monasteries hire them too, or was it just householders?
Many people hired them a lot when there was a funeral or some auspicious occurrence. Yeah. You would have somebody for days and weeks reciting texts.
Hire her, bring her in. She lives at your house for several months and recites these texts. That's what she did. And one interesting point about her story, which actually shows up in the stories of a lot of these famous practitioners, is that being terrifically gifted and understanding everything very thoroughly intellectually is not enough. The story of Naropa is like this. There's another sort of founding figure in a school of Tibetan Buddhism, where he's very educated. He's like the president of the biggest university in India. But one day, an old woman comes along and taps him on the shoulder and says, "But do you really understand this stuff?" And the same thing happened to Machik Labdrun when she was 16. She met one of her teachers, Sunam Drakpa, and had this classic encounter where he says, "Young Acharya, you seem very learned indeed, but do you really know the meaning of these texts?" And then she gives explanation. It goes on for about a page and a half. You know, she's a long-winded kind of erudite explanation. And then Sunam Drakpa says, "You indeed appear to know well how to explain the meaning, but you have not yet integrated it totally into your mind stream." And the neat thing about this is what she does next, because I could imagine going, "What do you mean? I just explained it." And no, all she says is, "How does one do this?" So she has this capacity to just simply dive in when opportunities appear for her. She doesn't sort of camp out in what she already knows. And this goes through her whole life story. You know, how does one do this? And then he explains to her, "Understanding of non-duality is a great fire which destroys the darkness of ignorant clinging to a self. So you should do it," he says. And then she goes off and does it. And becomes very much a changed woman in the story. It's like she went from being a very sort of neat and proper young woman living in a monastery, although not a nun. And the description is, after she had practiced in the way that this lama had suggested, that she then wore whatever came to hand and hung out with whoever was around and ate whatever was put in front of her and was somewhat changed. But there was still another level. When she was about 20, she starts getting messages that she should meet and become the consort of someone by the name of Tupa Bhadra, who's coming from India. And the story is really funny because she has to have this told to her about 20 times. There's Tara shows up and says, "By the way, Tupa Bhadra is coming from India and you should get to know him." Then a red dakini comes, then a black dakini comes, and seven white women, and finally a white girl on a white mule. So she gets all of this information, and she's still saying, "I don't know who this guy is. These prophecies, what are they worth? Might they not be some clever demonic trick? But what is his family lineage? Where is he from?" You know, there's just this constant sort of sense of, wait a minute, who is this guy? Even though she's getting miraculous appearances telling her that she should get to know him. So she kind of drags off to this place, like stops in to debate some geshes on the way and then stops over here to receive some teachings. She eventually actually goes to the house where all these interesting people told her she should go, and takes a job there reciting texts for this wealthy family, and Tupa Bhadra shows up. And then she spends 17 days ignoring him after he gets there. Ignoring him or arguing with him. And I like this because the course of spiritual practice, just like the course of true love, just doesn't run smooth, to completely mangle Shakespeare. We can have everything we want right in front of us, but recognizing it is the hard part. I've never actually seen any dakinis or anything myself, but you know, I can have a lot of signs pointing, saying this, and say, no. Because we have such strong attachment to the form of what we're doing. We're form addicts. And even though the form isn't fun, and I really don't like it. It's very hard. It's harder than you would think to open it up. So seeing someone like Magic Lovdrin, you know, who is, gosh, she's a lineage figure, you know, going through all of this kind of backing and forthing about meeting a man is kind of interesting. Ngokchang Rinpoche told me that he thought this part of this story was kind of required because you couldn't have a woman in a Buddhist story having sex unless she was resisting it all the way. But I enjoyed it nevertheless. But she finally does get together with him. And the description of this is just gorgeous. But then on the evening of her 17th day there, on the 8th day of the lunar month, Bhadra and Lavdran entered the meditative absorption of skillful means and wisdom, which means practicing sexual yoga. Light pervaded the entire house, and the benefactress Lama Drun, fearing that the butter lamps had set the house ablaze, ran up to have a look. All she saw was a five-colored light similar to a rainbow which pervaded the entire house, and within this, all ablaze, were two moons in union, one white and one red. Apart from this, she didn't see anyone, and frightened by it, she left the rooftop chapel and went back to sleep. And then Magic Lovdrin says to her hostess, "I've been deceived by the vulgar prophecies of some malevolent demon. I've been seduced," she tells her lamas. And both her lamas tell her this is a very good thing. "It will benefit beings." Her root lama says, "You never took ordination as a nun. You should go live with him and your family lineage will increase." So she does, and has two sons and a daughter with him. And her son, Gelwa Dundrup, was one of Ngokchang Rinpoche's teachers. Chime Rigsin Rinpoche was a reincarnation of her son, Gelwa Dundrup. And he didn't start practicing until he was 42. Had to go off and do a number of other things first in the story. But when he did become a practitioner, his entire motivation or center of attention as a practitioner was his love for his mother. As simple as that. "Mother who in the beginning created my body, mother who later gave me food and drink, mother who finally made me recognize the nature of my mind, mother of great kindness, in front of you I bow down." But it's possible that one of the most fundamental and simple human relationships could be that strong a focus of practice. Ngokchang Rinpoche is not somebody I've ever seen cry except this one time. He was telling the story that there's a yogic song that's a guru yoga for Magic Lovdrin that we practice, and Rinpoche said that he learned it from Chime Rigsin Rinpoche, who was the incarnation of the sun, and that Chime Rigsin Rinpoche had said, "When I sing this, I can hear my mother's voice singing it." She taught him this, and it's the only time I ever saw Rinpoche tear up is when he described that. That connection can be right down to us from her through her son. Simplest and commonest human experience, having a mother. And all three of her children were lineage holders in her tradition. She's known for compiling the whole body of teachings that's called Chud, which has various levels. These drums are used in a practice of Chud. It comes into our lineage via Ramrik Thakin Chud. husband of Kumchinaro Lingma.
And the Tarama.
And the Tarama. And the last little bit from her life that I like, this compilation of practices known as Chöd was a first in the Tibetan tradition in that it did not come from India. It was indigenous to Tibet. And the story is that when the word got back to India, that this was happening, that she was teaching, and the story moves to India and some panditas, some teachers in India discussing this situation, because it was a matter of concern to them. They say, "We have heard rumors about an unknown religious tradition recently introduced as the Chöd of Mahamudra. Its founder is said to be a woman with three eyes who is considered to be an emanation of the Great Mother of Wisdom. Either she is indeed, or she is Mara or some evil spirit incarnate, in which case she will be difficult to subjugate. Moreover, it is equally difficult to know how to do so, for after having perverted the whole of Tibet, she is quite capable of contaminating India as well. We should therefore send someone out to Tibet to assess the situation." And I read that boy, I thought, that sure sounds familiar. So three of these panditas fly in to Tibet to check this out, and Machik Labrin's attendant runs into Machik Labrin's hut and says, "Right above our hermitage there are three men of bluish complexion with piercing eyes and black silken shoulder blankets. They're definitely not from around here. They're Nepalese or something." So she receives them courteously and over a number of pages further in the story convinces them and approximately 50,000 other people that what she's doing is legit. Several paragraphs in the story of just all the other people coming. Oh, Machik Labrin is going to debate these panditas, and all they come from all the different places. And this part of the story,
in Tibet, that's kind of like a prize fight.
Yeah, right.
Religious debate is kind of like, let's go see who has the stuff, who gets their nose bloody, and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Is it still that way now?
It is.
Oh, monastic debates are big.
Oh, yeah. There's a whole dance, physical, you flap your hands and you do things like that. Yeah. So this was sort of the great Dharmic prize fight of the 11th century in Tibet. And it's just interesting because we're kind of in the same spot now with Buddha Dharma in the West, in the United States, and in Europe, that it has come from Tibet, and we, you know, are eternally in the debt of the people who have made that connection. But there's a point where it has to turn around and start to be local. Many of those people who came from Tibet are dying now. They're old, and their students have to carry it on, and it's not easy. Teachers who are not Tibetan, who are Westerners, face a certain amount of skepticism, more so than if you could walk in here and see a nice Tibetan sitting here. I just put that out to you as a thought project, whether that would be different. A lot of people, even just unconsciously, there's, you know, it somehow seems more like the real deal if it's coming from somebody kind of exotic. And this is no different than what happened in Machik Labrin's time. It's part of how the whole process works, that we're at this same sort of turning point now where people like Ngatron Rinpoche and Khandra Dachen are carrying it forward in English, in Britain and the U.S., and running into some panditas who want to question that. So it's very encouraging to read a story like this and realize, yeah, this has been going on for a long time. All we have to do is just keep keep doing it, keep practicing, keep it real. And we have the possibility of offering something that might actually be helpful. When I look at what's happening in the world now, and I think we could put this out there, that you don't have to make a territory out of your spirituality. It can be opened. It doesn't have to be something used to divide people. Then we'd have something, our lineage of enlightened women would have something to offer. Does anybody have questions, by the way?
I'm interested to know, as a tradition that was non-monastic, are the practices distinguished from monastic practices?
Yes.
How do you bring the practice into daily life?
Ergen's going to talk about that some. I'll say just a little something. Generally, the practices are simpler, by which we mean essentialized. They're not. Sakyan Mipam Rinpoche, who's the Dharma heir of Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, is a teacher who lives in Canada. He was the funniest thing, because he grew up in Tibet and in monasteries. And he said, well, in monasteries, people don't have a lot to do. They have a lot of time. So they tend to have these very, very long, elaborate practices. A lot of words, a lot of chanting. And the thing with, I don't know about anybody else, the life that I live, there's no way a practice that takes 3 hours of chanting to perform is going to happen very often. So the style of practice that we do is essentialized. It's right down to the nub. It's things that one can do on the spot. I think I told this story the last time we were here, and I will stop with this. There's a story I heard that I found very moving, where a woman with a couple of kids and a lot of responsibilities went to a teacher, and I can't even remember if it was a Roshi or a Lama, but the teacher, and said, what can I do? I would love to practice. I feel so drawn to the Dharma, but how can I practice? I have all this work I have to do. And that's traditionally why women were not part of these histories, is that if you had several children and a house to keep, you were considered to have had an inferior birth just because you were so busy, if nothing else. And supposedly this Lama said, pay attention to your hands. This is your practice. Whatever you're doing, pay attention to your hands. And the story is that she became fully realized just from doing that. And that's actually a practice that I do when I think of it, which is always the problem.
While you're typewriting?
Yeah, while I'm writing, while I'm cooking, while I'm cleaning the toilet. These rings that are part of this outfit represent, this is the Wajin, and this is the bell. If you got it close enough, you could see there. And the vow that goes with them is to never cease to work for the benefit of beings, and the idea being that because these things are always on my hands, I'm always practicing. All my movements are mudra, or hand, sacred hand gesture. So it's just a little thing that you wear these rings, and every time I see them, I think of that. And that's a practice. So that does that answer your question?
Yeah. Thank you.
On your website, in addition to being non-monastic, it also says non-liturgical, and I'm wondering if you could expand on that. I'm not quite sure what the implication of that is.
I'm going to turn this over to him because this is his topic. did you want to ask something?
Maybe you should talk first, so that you get your
my job. our lineage practices are definitely non-liturgical, in contrast to most tantric lineages and sutric lineages also, which are extensively liturgical. As Nachman Zimmer was saying, long practices of text chanting, which are guided practices of visualization, leading you through layers and levels and that sort of thing, in a very deliberate, very paced sort of way. Very much the flavor of outer tantra and where outer tantra and sutra overlap. Some tantric visualizations can be vastly long. Lots of introduction, preparation, offerings, supplication, the text itself, the Lama Naljor at the heart of the text, and long life wish paths. There are some tantric practices and empowerments that can go on literally for months working through texts. It's astonishing. And our lineage is very much essential, very essentialized. I mentioned at the beginning that this lineage is based in Dzogchen, and that means that we view any practice in the lineage, even tantric practice, visualization, yogic song, that sort of thing, from the perspective of Dzogchen. And in our lineage, that's described as looking at the principle and function of the practice. So because it's Dzogchen, it arises instantaneously as fully enlightened. And so our practices do not lead up and gradually build and describe the layers, and they are brief and instantaneous. The yogic song that we did at the beginning is a complete practice without any other need of any other text. There, Tartar Rinpoche in Santa Cruz says that he knows people who have practiced Seven Line Song exclusively and reached realization. And we, that's our view of practices like this. Now, because people's moods is maybe not the right word, but because the nature of people's mind and the nature of their confusion and the nature of our obscuration ebbs and flows and changes, we have lots of different practices, but they all very much come from that same perspective. They're really kind of direct hits. Yeah?
Thank you.
And that leads into the main part of what I want to talk about, which is, well, okay, this is a lineage of enlightened women. This lineage comes from women lineage holders, but what characterizes that? How is that different from a lineage that doesn't come from women? There are many different kinds of lineages. We are not the only non-celibate, non-monastic lineage by any means. There are many different lineages in the Nyingma school and some of the Kagyu schools that are Togdens, Togdenmas, Nakpas, Nakmas. It's not unheard of. It's certainly not as common as monks and nuns. But that in itself doesn't make this a woman's lineage or a lineage based in a female perspective. And what characterizes that in part is that essential nature, that non-extensive, non-liturgical nature. But in a more essential sense, all of Buddhism, whatever the school, talks about emptiness and form. That can also be expressed as wisdom and compassion, wisdom and method. It's in all schools, every text I've seen. It's expressed in different ways and different manifestations. Monks and nuns express wisdom and compassion in perhaps a different way than Nakpas and Nakmas do, celibacy, non-celibacy, etc., etc. I'll talk about that in a second. But wisdom and compassion, emptiness and form, pervades Buddhism. Everything else is built around it. And in the tantric scheme, in the tantric view, women manifest primarily wisdom, and men manifest primarily method. that is not to say that women are wisdom and men are method. The view in the Arotera is that women are externally wisdom and internally method. And that men are externally method and internally wisdom. And so there is this mirroring that happens. There is also traditionally the thought and the expression of Khandropa, which is a man whose primary expression is wisdom, and Pa Mo, which is a woman whose primary expression is method. So it's not codified and rigidified into archetypes, but this is the way that emptiness and form reflect each other in the scheme of this lineage. And so extensive form, elaborate ritual, lots of liturgical practice, very ornate, edifices, big institutions, all this in our lineage would be considered an expression of method and form and manifest maleness. And the manifest femaleness of this lineage is the essential non-monastic, much more organic is such a loaded word, especially in Northern California. much more essential and much more spontaneous, much more subtle is a good word sometimes. But it, yogis and yoginis, very itinerant, not building up big institutions, big monastery buildings, traveling, wandering, carrying their instruments. You make your music, and as soon as you stop, it's gone. It's not a big establishment of structure. It's essential. It disappears into emptiness, arises from emptiness when people sit down to practice. Yeah? Are there any questions?
What carries it's kind of devoid of structure. What is it, primarily an oral tradition? If it's not liturgical, what fosters the continuity, the practice?
Lineage, person-to-person transmission, which is also true in all the other lineages of Buddhism, and especially Vajrayana. Lineage that's broken in Vajrayana is not considered functional anymore. So that also has to be there, because there's always wisdom and compassion, method and emptiness. But in this lineage, yes, exclusively oral, up until the current generation with popular books, internet, email, all that kind of thing.
Okay.
You know, our lamas are very practical and modern people. But yes, the previous generations of this lineage were oral exclusively.
So that's a big change, it sounds like.
Well, except that it hasn't changed the nature of the lineage. It's just changed the means of communication. You know, in the previous generation of this lineage, people lived in the same valley, and they may have to travel for commerce or something like that, but it was possible to transmit to everybody, person to person. Mm-hmm. You know, books and emails alone are not considered enough. There still has to be person to person transmission, but they're very useful tools. They are not, these books and emails and such are not established now as text to create a liturgical lineage. They're just aids.
So these books and other ways of writing things down may come and go, but the lineage is held still in the oral tradition?
Yes, and you know, even whenever there's a text, there's always commentary. Yeah? texts without commentary are not considered useful as practices unless there is instruction. How do you use the text? How do I understand the text? The books are commentary. They're not the text. Okay.
Transmission. Mm-hmm. Least transmission. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Could you explain to me the symbology of the drums and how they're made? Are they made from one piece of wood and carved equally, or are they two pieces that have been joined together?
I'll explain that briefly, but gladly. The drum represents form, and the bell on the left side, drum on the right side, bell on the left side represents wisdom. Emptiness. There's, in Tantra, there's all this play back and forth, back and forth.
I understand that. Mm-hmm.
This drum is made from three pieces of wood turned on a modern lathe. I've seen them, I've never seen one this big, and our lineage favors big drums made from anything less than two pieces, because you have to go in with your tools from each side. So I've always only seen them joined together. I've seen them laminated from more pieces, but they're put together as basically as two bowls, although there's a hole in between. Yeah.
So basically, we could say that they also represent the androgynous part of ourselves, the inside, outside. Female, male joined together, and in the movement of the sound, you're activating both of them, the same as the heart works.
Both of the symbols contain the other within them.
Yeah.
There's always, here we have the symbol of emptiness. There's this hollow space which is required for this to function, but it needs a handle as method to activate it. These active beaters are moving around, but the only thing that makes this work is the empty space inside it.
But you're also activating it with your hand.
Yes, but what I'm saying is there is emptiness and form in both.
Yes.
And that's very important and very deliberate. Yeah? Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Also, when we play those, there's a good deal of method criticism, ideas about how the drum is played. The bell, you just play it. However it sounds is how it sounds. You don't correct the sound of the bell, but you can really work on that drumming forever, you know.
You know, the bells, we never polish or manipulate the bell part. They are left as they are. Now the handle, the method part, can be polished and shined up and improved, but the bell is considered left alone as it is. Yeah?
Yeah, I have a question. I'm not used to the use of the word method. Is that more like where we might say the masculine aspect? I mean, is that how you're
in this way of explaining things? Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You know, wisdom, method. Emptiness, those are all on the quote female side.
Mm-hmm.
Method, skillful means, compassion, form. These are all in the schema on the male side. Manifest, unmanifest.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing to remember, though, is that in Buddhism, these are not dual.
Mm-hmm.
They're not separate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, form is the manifest quality of emptiness. And emptiness is the unmanifest quality of form.
Mm-hmm.
They're not dual. And it really is important mm-hmm. to understand that and remember that. Because these things are teased out and divided apart to talk about them mm-hmm. as practices, as tools, as methods. But it's important to remember that they are all empty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Is anything dual by your teaching?
Yes and no.
No.
Everything, and our language is set up in terms of form. So we have to be very careful about how we talk. It's very easy to slip into, oh yeah, I understand that, but we have to go always one step behind our own language and make sure we are clear about what we're saying, because it locks us very quickly into thinking in a dualized, form-centered sort of fashion. Essentially, the diagnosis of Buddhism is that we are all form addicts, and that by one means or another, we need to be cured of this. And so the sutric traditions say, well, just stay away. Let it go. All these forms, they just have to be abandoned because they're attachment pits. And so you renounce your identity, you take a new name, you shave off your hair, which looks different in different people, you adopt a uniform, you live in an institution. It's you embrace emptiness and renounce your form. Yeah. Well,
but you embraced a very specific other form in so
doing. Of course. Because why can it be no other way?
Oh, I'm not suggesting it. Well, how can what be another way?
Well, it's not possible to live, to be without form. There always is form and emptiness.
Right.
But you renounce the particularity of your own form and thereby gain, by adopting a uniform form, you embrace emptiness.
Because it is kind of characterless.
It's not individual.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You become empty in relation to individual forms.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it said.
And it sounds like an outer device in order to accomplish an inner result of letting go of the form, mm-hmm. which is, seems to me, it, under some circumstances at least, could be done without any change in form at all.
Of course, but that's very difficult because, again, you know, our language and our upbringing and generation upon generation of humans to survive, to bring in the crops, to recognize, that's a raccoon, that's a bear. There's a difference. I pay more attention to that than I do to that. Those distinctions have been very important to us, and you can see why people really come down on the side of being skillful at form and trying to do away with the emptiness things, well, kind of like death and, you know, loss, things that really are indicative of a bad time sometimes. We tend to eschew those. And so breaking out of or letting go of a normal social mode can be very important and critical to support practice. But of course it's not the only way. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, within the tantric lineages, there's no requirement that we renounce sexuality or employment or other kinds of involvement with form. We do not have to renounce all involvement with form or as much involvement with form as possible. But it's critical for Tantra to function as a practice that we recognize from the outset that all forms are empty, so that there is nothing by which we feel we can gain solidity in our own existence by grasping at them. We have to recognize them and therefore in the mirror as us, as empty. And so we cannot practice Tantra without reaching the base, which is recognizing that emptiness.
So and you're not giving up your ability to deal with form in the world. You're holding it in a different way, it sounds like.
Well, in terms of theory and in terms of practice at times, yes. But tantric practitioners also practice renunciation, because at times that's what we need to do. That's the most appropriate mm-hmm. practice. Yeah? All of us, whatever our practice is, go through a period of renunciation, even if it's only at the beginning of that practice. We sit, mm-hmm. we are empty before the practice arises.
In choosing to practice, you renounce whatever else it was you could be doing. I mean, it can be that simple.
About maybe not so metaphysical, it's more personal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I come from a liturgical tradition, although I began in the Dzogchen, which now kind of more of a women's lineage, Sultram Aliyom, who just came back from Ayukat Machig's cave, and the Lama there recognized her as an emanation of Machig, which for her, being one of the first ordained women in the Nyingma to Vajrayana tradition in the late 60s, has taken then almost 40 years for to be find this form, this to be recognized as Machig, as the emanation of Machig. And a great deal of her teaching through this lineage has been to keep the form, the elements of the practice pure, so that I think as Americans we tend to just want to take little bits and pieces of things and put it together, rather than to follow it in a traditional method. But sometimes I wonder what I'm doing, in the sense that it requires a great deal of discipline just to wear robes, for example, but the robes help support the practice. To like you said, it takes forever to learn the drum. I mean, I'm still working with the drums, but you can't do the chud without the drum. I mean, to recognize this emptiness form, had to have that as experience comes through that practice. So I guess my question is it seems so difficult to pass this tradition on, to pass this idea on, because it requires, for many people, it seems so complicated. And in some ways, it's very complicated.
Especially when you're bridging cultures.
Yeah, it's an attempt to bridge culture. So, you must find this frustrating at times to get the message across, because there's so much that's alien to us.
That can also be very useful. You know, if I sit down here in jeans and a Pendleton shirt and start to talk about emptiness and form and other aspects of mind without any sort of a form, it's very difficult to grasp a hold of it. It's much easier to get a package deal with some cultural trappings and then get the wisdom from that. But I think it's very useful. I think it can go the other way too. You can get cultural trappings and not make the spark. That's also possible. But I personally feel that we are very fortunate in our lineage to have a lot of personal contact with our lamas. There's a limit they put on how many personal students they take, and then once it reaches that point, then there are other people empowered to be lamas who will take their own students, and so you have always a personal connection.
When I feel like that, the way you were describing, the only thing I can do is return to the basis of practice, of my own practice, and the things that I've been taught, and the example that's been manifested to me by the teachers, you know, my personal teachers and other people I've seen who have radiated, you know, realization, which in the presence of which the forms are transparent. You can see how the emptiness and the form flow into and out of each other. And when I feel like, you know, oh, this is, you know, how is it possible to communicate this? You know, the only thing I can do is fall back on the direct experience and on my own practice, and you know, a certain amount of good old-fashioned faith. I know this is real. I know it in my own life. And so I have some trust that will communicate. And I agree with you about the necessity of being faithful to the forms that I've been taught. That I don't feel like I've got any ground to stand on to start inventing stuff. I mean, I think eventually things will change.
As Buddhism comes.
Yeah, as it grows further into our culture, there will be indigenous things arising. But in the position that I'm in, I just try and faithfully hand on what I was given. And because I've seen how real that is, I trust that. I don't know if that helps.
No. I mean, that's what my take on it, too. Yeah. Just that at times it seems like, it kind of puts me back into more of a Hinayana mode of I can do the best I can just to get my own truth around this.
Sure.
It's really difficult in a culture that doesn't understand the symbols and doesn't have a place for us in a cubbyhole. As many problems as there are with doing that, when we've gone to Asia, it's an amazing experience.
Very interesting. Yeah.
You walk into shops and mm-hmm. I remember have you been to Kathmandu?
No, I've never traveled.
And Tamil is a very touristy part of Kathmandu, mm-hmm. and it used to be the source of hash bars for Westerners and all kinds of stuff. A lot of souvenirs still there. They have a lot of interesting implements and stuff for sale, but it's not a big bunch of monasteries and stuff. It's really a touristy part of town. I walked into a shop there looking at stones. They have a lot of turquoise and other worked stones that I was looking for some. And this woman stood up and greeted me, and as they often do, just because you're a customer. Mm-hmm. And I looked at some, found some stuff I wanted, and I said, well, how much would these be? And she says, well, these are 26 rupees a gram, or whatever it was. So I picked out the ones I wanted, and the standard there is to haggle. You have to haggle, or you're an idiot. And they get very confused if you don't haggle. And so I walked over and I said, well, I think 26 rupees a gram is a good price, but I prefer to pay 15. What do you think about that? And she looked very embarrassed, and she put her head down. She said, I'm so sorry. My cost on these stones is 26 rupees a gram. When I saw you in your Nakpa's robes come into the store, I gave you the best price I can give you. And she was embarrassed that she couldn't do any better. And little interactions like that are just stunning for us. Standing on the street in San Francisco with my lama in my robes, I've had people screech their car to a halt, jump out, shake their fist at the damn faggots in dresses, and roar on. It really is hard here. It's really hard when our culture doesn't understand it at all and actually feels threatened by it in a lot of ways.
They keep telling me to go back to where I came from.
that is hard. That's really hard.
But I wasn't asking for sympathy. I think it's like what I want is this idea that that it isn't perhaps our generation to make those changes.
But we can just do what we do.
I mean, it's more of our, I think, to transmit this, it's more our responsibility to keep it as close as we can to what it was like Tibet before the diaspora.
And our Lama said the same thing, that it's very important for us to maintain and project, show the traditional implements as true and sincere form as we can. That doesn't mean this fabric maybe it will be different, but we certainly maintain these forms, and that's the important thing for this generation as we learn.
When you're in your professional activities, are you wearing your robes?
Yeah.
So there's a understanding that when you're doing, like working in the world, that there's an appropriate vehicle or appropriate dress for that world, mm-hmm. and then when you're mm-hmm. as a practitioner, then so what are those boundaries? Like, when do you wear your robes and when do you not?
When it's a Buddhist activity.
Okay. So they're
and
more of a formal.
Teachings, retreats, that sort of thing.
He could, you know, my could wear them. Sure. I wore mine for 5 years before I became ordained, just to make sure I could do it. And it was an experiment, and just to reinvent my sense of self-identity.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, for example, we have vows that we never cut our hair, and obviously I can't put that on and take that off.
I was wondering about the symbolism of what you're wearing, like the red with the blue and the white and the long white skirt and so on. What I assume that has symbolic meaning in your language. Could you talk a little about that?
Well, as we said before, we have slightly different ordinations. There are Nakpas, which wear the same dress that Nakma Zerme wears. Their shawl looks the same. Their shirt, their tonga looks the same, the skirt is the same. My ordination is Naljorpa, and they're also Naljormas, and we wear this outfit. Or you probably can't tell because it's all scrunched up, but my shawl is different.
Mm-hmm.
The pattern is different.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right.
The skirts are the same, but my tonga is different, and I wear this called a gomtak, which is literally translates as a meditation belt or strap, and reflects the nature, as I said earlier, of Anu Yoga practice. It's one of the innermost tantras and involves a lot of yogic practice. Straps like this will be worn, wrapped around, supporting an arm or a knee or something, and pressure points are involved sometimes. But that's the outer symbolic nature of this wear. This shirt for us is always blue, but it's the shape of a lay person's shirt. Yeah? So it's a very common style of Tibetan shirt. You might see it with long sleeves. So it shows this sacred or spiritual expression of that which is common and because it's going more and more towards the inner tantras, it's less and less deliberately separate from the secular and mundane, quote, world. It's less and less elaborate. It's less and less symbolic. So, for example, Nakma Zerme's tonga is the same pattern monks and nuns wear, but it's a different color.
And yours is more like the common person might
the shape,
wear.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The shape, mm-hmm. But always blue, which represents spirituality.
Blue is a representation of space, but it's also linked with Dzogchen. There's a sutra, a text in Dzogchen called the Song of the Cuckoo, and there's this blue color is on the bird. The Chamtab, the skirt, has a specific number of panels, 6 panels for the 6 tantras. There's a band at the top and the bottom which represent the unity of secular and sacred. It's supposed to be patched because it represents symbolically the shroud of a leper. There are all sorts of symbolic meanings. The earrings are part of our stock wear. They are made of conch shell, which represents kadag, a primal purity. The Dzogchen view that things arise perfectly pure, but they also represent, they're said to jangle menacingly, and they, because there's gold and also this white that kind of looks like bone, they represent joyous ornaments like you would see in a joyous tanka, where they have lots of gems and silks flowing and all this very splendid stuff, but it also represents the wrathful ornaments like you would see in a wrathful yidam with bones and skulls and blood and weapons and all that kind of stuff. So it's showing that all vehicles are available to the practitioner of the inner tantra.
And why the long hair? I was with a meditation group years ago that said long hair was because it acted like an antenna for vibrations from the universe or something. Is that...
Yeah, we can't afford that.
like
Samson or something, where the, it preserves
well, strength? Because hair, everybody's hair is a little bit different. It's an expression, a natural expression of individuality. Yeah. So in the sutric method, it's renounce. You shave it off. You don't spend time messing with it. You don't style it. You don't mess around with it. It's a distraction. It's also an individuator. But in the tantric lineages, we are viewing form as the ornament of liberation. All these splendid differences in form are the glorious ornaments of realization. And so we let it come out and express and don't damage it. Yeah? For men, the hairs are viewed as dakinis. So these are the expressions symbolically of my wisdom nature, which for me, because it's unmanifest, is hidden from me. So I have all these symbols to embrace and remind me of finding my own wisdom nature. For women, hairs are the dakas, are the expressions of method. And it works the same way.
Having the hair uncut is another. Remember, I said there was a vow that went with the rings that had to do with never ceasing to benefit, act for the benefit of everyone. And the vow that's related to not cutting the hair is there's a couple of them that point to it, but one of them is not regarding anything as impure or defiled, and another is a very interesting. It's one of these practices that is only a matter of how you look at things, and relating to this reflection of the genders, where a woman might be externally wisdom and internally method. As a woman, I might vow to practice viewing the entire phenomenal world as method, as male or masculine. And it starts with the hair. It's like the whole phenomenal world starts with this. So I don't mess with it. I let it do its thing, out of taking an interest in it and out of respecting it the exploration of what that means, what that vow means. So you regard your hair as the daka or dakini, whichever the opposite of your temporary gender assignment for this life, this is. So these are the dakas. And so I don't cut them. I try not to even break them off.
I thought perhaps it was because your husband cuts his hair. And he had a hard day, and he also wears part of the robe, but not all of it. So I figured that it had to do with your ordination somehow. And it does.
It does
have great symbolic meaning.
But Carl's hair is his own.
Yeah. Thank you. Very interesting.
And so these practices of view, as Zeremy was talking about, relate to your question about practices within the world of activity. And there are many of them.
The one I just described is a whole life worth of practice, mm-hmm. just to practice that regarding of the world.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested to know on that theme how both of you living and working in the professional world and a Western professional world, how you find that particular stage as food for your practice or a challenge to your practice? Or
both. I would say my own experience that it's quite difficult. It is difficult to live in a world that takes samsara seriously and has no desire to stop doing that. And that judges you by the standards of samsara and judges you by the standards of how you appear to take samsara seriously and refuses to look at its own baggage. I find that very, very difficult sometimes. But on the same time, to live in that world and not become its subject, not buy into it, and not give up being a practitioner is very powerful practice. I would put it in the wrathful category.
What you wear is very beautiful, I think.
Thank you. I have a little thing about the word wrathful. I just want to say that a lot of times we misunderstand that it means, you know, demonic or something. It just means with great force.
We describe it as practice that you know, we have peaceful, joyous, and wrathful practice in the Vajrayana. Wrathful practice, the means of the practice is contact with your own aversions. So it's not that it's, you know, whipping up evil or anything. It's just smack in your face, your aversions, dealing directly with aversion.
My own anger, my negativity, it's right there in that beautiful, wrathful form if I'm doing duty practice.
Well, and even aversion on a very primal level, you know, things that you do not want to experience.
Right.
You know, as opposed to the other two, which are dealing with your indifference and with your attachment, your attraction.
This should be considered wrathful.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Because you embrace everything bad happening to yourself, every loss to yourself.
In response to your question, it's, you know, as Ergen said, it's difficult. For all of the reasons, I mean, you put that so well. You know,
I've had a lot of time.
Being at the, oh, me too. I mean, the first thought I had was, well, I don't have any choice. This is just simply how I live. I don't have much in the way of an option to do something else other than engage. So, given that, what's interesting to me is it's that sense of being emptiness to the forms that I think we mentioned before, because I go in and out of these different worlds where I'm this person, but then I step out of that and I'm over here and I'm that person. And we all do this, you know. You might be a daughter and a mother and a grandmother and an aunt, and, you know, you might be all of these different people. So, you know, I'm, you know, senior technical writer for a payroll company in Oakland, and then I step out of that and I'm a Scottish dancer, and I step out of that and I'm a horsewoman, and I step out of that and I'm a brush cutter, you know. And it's like, as I move through these forms, what's the same? It's very interesting to me that I step in and out of these different worlds. You know, like the Scottish dance community in the Bay Area is this very tight little group of people who all know each other and they all go to classes every day, you know. And I step in once a week for my exercise and I go to this one class. I step in this whole little world, all these people know each other. Hi, how are you doing? We'll talk about this, you know, all the stories, whatever he was doing. Step back out, go home, and then I'm Carl's wife. I'm in that role. That's very interesting, and that's, you know, that's part of how I practice as a householder yogini, you know, someone who practices in the world of form.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, very, very much so.
Yeah.
And so I guess I have a question for both of you. It's a little bit loaded, so but it's that: do you find by being in sort of confronting the samsaric world so directly, as opposed to being in a monastic tradition, that in fact there might be greater opportunity for realizing the sameness between the different roles that you play than if you were in a more monastic sort of tradition?
I think that there are so many different methods because there are so many different people. You know, for me, I think I'm in the best place for who I am. But for someone else, it would be different. I don't think you can make that kind of a delineation.
It's either hard or it's hard.
It's either hard or it's hard. Our Lama has a tendency to say.
I've never lived in a monastic situation, you know, been on retreat, which mimic is not the right word, but parallels renunciation. You renounce any activity other than your practice on retreat. So there is that. But so I can't say about what it's like to live in a monastic institution, but my imagination is that it would be much harder. It can be difficult to maintain the knowledge and the awareness that you're a practitioner in a sea of samsaric deliberateness. But I think the hardest thing for us in our culture, certainly for me personally, is when there's not enough variety. And certainly the samsaric world, we're expert in our culture at offering variety. So, you know, and the problem is, of course, you get carried away by that, or you get distracted, or they came out with that. You can just get swept along and never recognize what's happening. And the retreat situation is very good for that, because nothing's happening. You just get to see how you relate, when the only thing there is to relate to is the inside of this room. So I imagine monastic life to be harder myself.
Thank you.
And maybe that means for me it would be, but I don't know. It's absolutely valid method, practice, system, jhana, vehicle. There's no question of that. People will tell you that Tantra or Vajrayana is better, is higher, and our teacher is very clear that the highest vehicle is the one that's the most useful for you. When he talks about vehicles, he often talks about, you know, walking versus bicycle versus car versus helicopter. And everybody says, well, you know, helicopter is the highest vehicle, but if you don't know how to fly when you crash and die, and then it wasn't any use at all. Walking would have been much more useful. So, has that answered your question?
Yeah. I told you it was a loaded question.
Yeah. How are we for time, dear hosts?
It's a little after 9. So.
Does that mean we're late already?
Yeah, you're late.
No. Or we weren't going to do that.
But it's wonderful. You know, so maybe, you know, one more question. And then
okay. Would people like to do another question or another song?
Song.
A lot of hesitation there.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to put it to a vote.
You should put it to a vote, okay.
Yeah. We talked on the way up here about what song should we do if we do another song. We could do the mantra of Yeshit Sogyal, which has a tune, and we'll play with the bell and the drums as well. Or we could do the Lama Nalja of Machit Lapran, the Guru Yoga of Machit Lapran, which also uses the bell. And, for me?
Which is small.
They're both about the same.
Being we don't know either.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave that up to you.
The first one about the story that you told.
The first song we did?
Babe, right here.
No, the first song you mentioned of the two.
The second one of the two was that.
Machit Lapran.
Was the tune that our Lama's teacher remembers hearing in his previous life. So yes, that's that tune.
But the name of the first song again was
the mantra of Yeshit Sogyal. Mm-hmm. Well, they're both
right. I'd go for Magic Mantra.
Okay.
Do you have a Kongling?
I have a Kongling, yes. We don't have the text for that.
No.
I have a copy. Is it a pass this around. This is Matri Glocker and the image, and this is the test of the same.
Oh, my goodness.
This is the
one.
Lama Naldo means Guru Yoga of Matri Glocker. This tune, in every Chö tradition I'm aware of, this tune is part of the Chö ritual. And so as part of this short practice, we use the conlang, the thigh-bone trumpet, which anyone who knows about Chö will recognize as part of.
The tune repeats three times, so as we go along, maybe you pick it up and sing it too.
Thank you.
coming.
Thank you.
That's a good question.
Thank you.
Much welcome to you.
If you found it worth your evening, you could have been doing other things.
But not anything so interesting.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear you say that.
Thank you so much for blessing this store, you know, with your energy and your songs. Many Rivers Books and Tea has adopted the Buddhist custom of dana or generosity. There is a donation bowl on the counter, and a portion of the donation goes to our guests so that they can support their tradition and their practice, and a portion goes to the store so that we can continue to offer events like this and many Rivers Books and Tea. Any amount that you can give would be gratefully accepted. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Oh, and books. books here.
Thank you so much.